Welcome to this month's Author Audio, brought to you by Quality Progress Magazine and ASQ, the global voice of quality. My name is Megan Schmidt, contributing editor for Quality Progress. I'm speaking with the author of the Quality in the First Person column, Broken Arrow. Jack Revelle is a consulting statistician at Revelle Solutions in Santa Ana, California. After 5 decades of sworn secrecy, Jack is finally able to talk about his role in diverting a nuclear disaster. In January 1961, a U.S. Air Force B-52G bomber accidentally dropped 2 hydrogen bombs in a tobacco field near Goldsboro, North Carolina, before crashing. Then, Jack was a 25-year-old explosive ordnance disposal officer in the Air Force. He and his 10-man team were sent from the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio to deactivate and safely remove the 2 nukes. In his column, he explains this broken arrow, which is military jargon for an accident involving a nuclear weapon, had a significant influence on his eventual career in quality. Thanks so much for talking with me today, Jack.
Well, you're very welcome, Megan. Considering what we'll be talking about, I'm just happy to be here. In fact, I'm happy to still be alive.
So, Jack, in your article, you say that nothing could have prepared you for this broken arrow. What about this experience made it especially challenging for you and your crew? Did you ever face anything of this magnitude again?
Yes, Megan, I sure did, both before and after the Goldsboro broken arrow. My first broken arrow occurred 6 months before the incident at Goldsboro. It involved an Air Force Bomark surface-to-air missile that was consumed in a fire at McGuire Air Force Base near Trenton, New Jersey. That particular event presented a great radiation challenge. Then, a year after the Goldsboro broken arrow, I was assigned as the Explosive Ordnance Disposal, or EOD, staff officer for Operation Dominant, also known as Joint Task Force 8, at Christmas Island, which is right in the middle of the Pacific, not too far from the equator, where I observed the final atmospheric test series of 25 brand new nuclear devices. They'd never been tested before. In addition to participating in these exercises, I was responsible for designing the rendering safe procedures, or RSPs, which would have been put to use if any of these nuclear devices had malfunctioned, which resulted in a broken arrow.
So how close were the 2 bombs at Goldsboro to exploding?
That depends a lot on who you talk to. As far as I'm concerned, very close. In fact, I believe that if everything that happened to each of the 2 individual nuclear weapons happened to just one of them, we could have very easily ended up with the Bay of North Carolina. That is a very different coastline on our eastern seaboard.
So do you mind talking a bit more about the conditions that led to the plane crash and the near explosion of the nukes?
I never object to talking a bit more. Ask anybody. During an in-flight refueling of the B-52, the jet fuel that it was receiving began to leak from the right wing. You have to know that the B-52G was what they call a wet wing. That is, all the fuel that was being pumped into the aircraft by the KC-135 through the boom from the 135 was going directly into the wing. And then, as a result of that leak, the stress associated with it led to the right wing of the aircraft, the B-52G, falling off. Then the additional stress resulted in the entire tail section of the B-52 breaking off, which ultimately exposed the bomb bay that contained 2 hydrogen bombs. They were sucked out of the back of the crashing aircraft and fell onto a tobacco field, with one landing upright like the Washington Monument. We've got some great pictures of that. And the other, penetrating the ground at what was estimated afterwards to be about 700 miles an hour, and then it buried itself well below the surface of the ground. After 8 days, we quit digging at somewhere around 50 or so feet, and they kept digging for about 5 months longer than that to find the one still missing part of the hydrogen bomb.
So what went through your mind when you were told about the incident?
My first thought, what, again? Remember, I'd been on my first broken arrow with the Bomark missile only 6 months before, but at least I was no longer a stranger to what happened. As a matter of fact, to the best of my knowledge, I am the only surviving EOD officer that has been involved with 2 separate broken arrows.
wondering, what was the first thing that you did after your 8 days in a hellhole?
Well, the hellhole, for those folks who haven't seen the column yet, is that big hole in the ground that we dug trying to find the second weapon that penetrated the ground at 700 miles an hour. And after the 8 days, when we went back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where we were stationed, I went to bed for some long overdue rest. You remember, we were working in the mud mixed with nuclear and explosive components from dawn to dusk for 8 consecutive days. The next morning, after I got that good night's sleep, I got up and decided to write a letter to my folks to let them know I was okay. Remember, they hadn't heard from me in over a week. And this was strictly, pen and paper. That was before even mainframe computers. Certainly no personal computers available at that point. This is 1961. I realized the severity of the event as I started to write to my folks and how my team and I had been in harm's way. And frankly, and I get goosebumps every time I think about it. Finally, after 8 days, my hands started to shake. I realized where I'd been, what I'd been doing. And that was quite a wake-up call to me.
How did this experience influence you in your decision to work in quality?
Well, really didn't take much thought to realize that it was the lack of quality that was the source of all the things that had gone wrong, from the wing falling off to the failure of the weapons to activate the way they were designed to. Even the Air Force Base's lack of preparedness to deal with a broken arrow was a lack of quality planning. If it hadn't been for the Salvation Army, we wouldn't have anything to eat or drink in the field for the first few days.
Looking back, is there anything you would have done differently?
You know, I give that a thought a lot of times, and the answer is not really. We, myself, and my 10-man team were all thoroughly trained, experienced, and worked very well together. In fact, I still communicate today with the four surviving members of my team. We were really a well-oiled machine, ready to take care of whatever fate had in store for us. A lot of things could have gone wrong while we were doing our job, but we got it done.
I have one more question for you, Jack. So how did you actually get involved in EOD, in the military?
Oh, that's a funny story. I got my BS in chemical engineering at Purdue, and at the same time I was taking advanced ROTC in the Air Force. And when the time came to graduate and to get commissioned, there was an Air Force sergeant who was responsible for assigning AFSCs, that's the Air Force Specialty Codes. That's a four-digit number that describes what your career or what career you're working in the Air Force. And he says, well, sir, remember, this is a guy that's like 20 years older than me. I'm about 20, he's about 40. And he says, well, sir, could you tell me, please, what it is that you'd like to do in the Air Force? And, being the wise guy that I am, I said, well, I'd really like to be a USO escort officer. And he chuckled, he said, that's pretty funny, but I'm afraid that's not going to happen. According to the Air Force manual on officers' careers, it says that in order to be a munitions officer, you need to be a chemical engineer. Well, sir, you're a chemical engineer, so I'm going to assign you as a munitions officer. And the next thing I knew, I was assigned to what was then Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, Colorado. That doesn't exist anymore. It was deactivated. And after I finished my 2 months of training as a munitions storage officer, I was assigned to my first permanent duty at Johnson Air Base in Japan, about an hour west of Tokyo. And I had about 30 people working for me, 20 American GIs and 10 Japanese nationals. We were operating a munition storage area, and two of the guys that worked for me were EOD. Now, at that point, I had never heard of EOD, or Explosive Ordnance Disposal, before. And so when the time came for me to render an annual performance rating on those two guys, as well as all the others, I said, look, fellas, help me. I'd like to give you a good performance evaluation, but I really don't know what you do. Can you tell me, please? And they said, Lieutenant, we can't tell you. You don't have the security clearance or the need to know. And I thought to myself, well, that's a really sad situation. And at the time, I was thinking about being a career officer, so I thought, it might be a really good idea for me to go get EOD qualified so that I would at least know what people were doing that were working for me. And so I applied for and got accepted to EOD school, which at that time was at the U.S. Naval Propellant Plant in Indian Head, Maryland. It subsequently has moved down to Eglin Air Force Base, which is where it is today. And when I finished my two-year tour in Japan, I went back to the States directly to EOD school, spent about 6 months there, and when I finished, I was assigned as the commander of the Detachment 4 of the 2702nd EOD Squadron at Wright-Patterson. Less than 30 days after getting there, I went on my first broken arrow, and that's kind of where we started at the beginning of this discussion.
Well, thank you, Jack, for sharing this incredible story.
Well, thank you, Megan, for this opportunity to let the members of ASQ know that the total dedication to quality that we all have can begin in some really unique ways. This was only one.
You can find Jack's article, Broken Arrow, in the August 2013 issue of Quality Progress magazine, as well as at our website, www.qualityprogress.com. This is Megan Schmidt of Quality Progress magazine, and thanks for listening.